Court will proceed to the third case of the day, United States versus McMath. Mr. Smith?
Good morning, Your Honors. I represent Appellant McMath along with my co-counsel, Mr. Hernandez. Mr. McMath is challenging his conviction under the felon in possession statute, and he raises three grounds for challenging his conviction and sentence. The first is the district court's failure to make any of the required findings under Batson. The second is the fact that the prosecutor made a series of statements during closing arguments that were improper and vouched for key witnesses. And the third is because his sentence was based on a factual finding that the government concedes was mistaken. With respect to the first issue, there's no dispute here that there weren't any on-the-record findings with respect to the Batson challenge. And so under the Supreme Court's decision in Snyder and this Court's decision in Taylor, reversal is required.
Now, I don't know what you're expecting the court to have done. I mean, the lawyer, Mr. Erickson, raises the Batson challenge. He certainly says something much more than just you've struck an African-American. He outlines briefly various characteristics of this person. The prosecutor, after a false start thinking that it matters that somebody's still left on, says he's angry, looked angry and not happy to be here. And the court just says the Batson challenge is denied. So it seems to me you're pinning this part of your appeal on the fact that the court doesn't preface that sentence with the sentence, you're right, I can see that his demeanor looked different, the Batson challenge is denied. And I just am concerned about how picky are we going to get with this, because it looks to me like it's clear that it's that kind of a challenge. It's a demeanor, if you will, attitude. How does this person look on the stand? And the judge, I don't think we should presume that the judge just frivolously said that. Why can't we infer that the judge accepts the prosecutor's reason?
Well, even the government's unclear about what basis the district court ruled on. At one stage it says, well, the district court implicitly found that no prima facie case was established. On the other hand,
I'm just trying to get to the underlying reason, though. I mean, Ms. Blackwood says race-neutral factors, expression on his face. That's all I can say. He looked angry and not happy to be here. Mr. Erickson, whether flippantly or seriously, I have no idea, says I think pretty much the whole jury looked like that. She says I disagree. But, the court's responding to this. It gives us context. We understand.
Well, Your Honor, here are the findings that the court, I believe the court should have made. Number one, should have made a finding as to whether the juror actually made that expression. There's nothing in the record indicating that the court necessarily found that the juror had made that expression.
Well, why isn't the fact that he denied the Batson challenge?
Well, the government argues in one breath that there wasn't any prima facie case. And then in the other says that the prosecutor's race-neutral explanation.
The government argued. The question is what other inference can you draw other than the fact that he accepted that?
Well, the other findings that the court should have made are, number one, was the defense counsel correct? Were there the other jurors with the exact same expression? Then the judge could have inquired into the prosecutor's reasoning.
It sounded to me when I read it that he was just, well, nobody wants to be here. I'm sure he didn't want to be there. The judge didn't want to be there. Nobody wanted to be there. So, you know, that's a throwaway line.
Well,
that's more humorous aside. Than
no, there's no evidence in the record that was some kind of joke. I know the government tries to make that argument, but the prosecutor certainly and the court.
You may not read that into the record, but I read it into what was said among all three of them. He had no reason to raise it except the one that was given by the prosecutor. The judge accepted that. Now, Batson is not an absolute that everybody who is of their race can't be thrown off. It's not an immunity thing. It's just that if you indicate, and almost all of us who tried cases, as you know,
yes,
took the position that there was somebody that you were talking to that you just knew was mad about being there and you didn't want him.
Well, the judge has to make credibility findings on the record and talk about whether the prosecutor's reasoning is credible. And On this record, it's hard to imagine a more flimsy excuse than the juror looked unhappy. That's basically saying, I don't like the look of that juror. There was no...
Sometimes a very good one.
Well, we have to have findings in order for the appellate court to be able to evaluate the district court's reasoning. And here there aren't any findings. And all we're asking for is, first, we believe that a new trial is warranted given the Supreme Court's ruling in Snyder, but at a minimum, a remand so the district court can explain why exactly it was that he felt that the Batson challenge should be rejected in this case.
Now, Mr. Smith, it struck me, just in a relative sense, that a stronger part of your appeal rests on these various statements that the prosecutor made, particularly at the end, and whether it's the comment that the government has conceded was out of line about the loss of their job, or whether it's bringing up DNA after the trial court has said we're not going to go into that. And I think, I mean, your burdens there are twofold. One, it's a plain error standard of review, which is always tough. And I guess even if it weren't plain error, you'd have to show why, in the light of all the evidence in the trial and the like, these were harmful errors. These were errors that may have affected our confidence in this verdict. So maybe you could turn to that.
Okay. Well, Your Honor, I believe that all of our arguments are strong ones in this brief. But I will proceed to the second one. And you're right that the government has conceded that one of the statements was improper, and I won't go through the rest of them. Basically, they fall into two categories, either vouching for key witnesses or introducing this evidence that wasn't introduced during trial. But going on to the real issue, which, as you note, is does this warrant a new trial? And there, I just direct the court to these cases that we marshaled from the various circuits, which are actually relatively uniform in saying, whereas here you have vouching for a key witness in the case, and the government concedes that Mr. McMath's conviction hinged on the testimony of these officers, that's conceded on appeal. Where you have vouching for key witnesses, and this court suggested in the Cottenham case that that was automatically prejudicial. And other courts have almost uniformly found that when you have a situation like that, a new trial is warranted because it is the kind of inherently prejudicial action by the prosecutor.
So what's the prosecutor supposed to do in response to an aggressive attack on the credibility of the prosecution's witnesses, here officers Boyack and Washington? Because the defense says eventually, I think you will come to the conclusion ultimately that the police were either lying or mistaken or both. And so this is sitting out there, and now the prosecutor is going to stand up and give the final part of the closing statement. I mean, surely the prosecutor is allowed to respond to that.
Oh, yes. And the prosecutor can point to the facts and evidence.
So why can't they say they weren't lying? Is that out of line after the defense has accused them of lying?
Well, when the prosecutor says they weren't lying, the prosecutor has to point to the facts and evidence. Could say, as she did later on here, at you know, that there were he could argue, well, their testimony was consistent. The two officers said the same thing.
And she says things
blah, blah, blah.
And she also points out that if you're taking a really fast turn to the right, you're not going to be thrown to the right side of the car. You're going to be thrown to the left.
Yes, but that was actually, that misstated the testimony at trial. Mr. McMath had not said that he was thrown from one side of the car to the other. And if he were thrown to the left side of the car, he actually would have been thrown away from the window where the gun was allegedly thrown out. So that statement not only mischaracterized Mr. McMath's testimony, but it also undermined her case, actually. But at any event, the key here is the one statement that she made was improper. There are ways, and this court has, you know, decided plenty of cases where the prosecutor has responded to similar arguments, and the court would, as deemed whatever their response was as proper. The issue here, really, we're moving on to the second stage and saying, well, is a new trial warranted? And I think the authorities that we cite are fairly uniform in saying under this circumstance they are. Plus, we have this added misconduct, which was the introduction of this these arguments that had been excluded about the frequency with which you get positive DNA or firearms.
Does she really say that, though? I mean, she, her language throughout the trial, frankly, I found, I'll put it nicely and say, pretty informal. But she says, well, I guess we're damned if we do and damned if we don't. Why did they even check for DNA and fingerprint evidence if it doesn't matter? I think she was, again, responding. That's what he says. And yet, if we hadn't checked for it, he'd be stomping and pounding the podium. And then she kind of concludes, sometimes you're lucky, sometimes you're not. Why is that actually the same thing as what the district court excluded? He didn't want somebody to stand up and say, usually we don't find DNA evidence, or usually this, or usually that.
Yeah, well, that was one of her statements. She actually made a couple others in the closing arguments. She referred to it being just pure luck, whether or not they obtained positive results or not, indicating that it was something that wasn't scientifically based or reliable or anything like that.
Do you think that slid over into the realm that the court was trying to keep out?
Yes, I do. That was the exact same thing that was discussed in that colloquy about the officer's testimony. In addition, she made this comment about, oh, Hollywood makes you believe that you're always going to have these results. It's the same argument she made when she was trying to get the evidence in when the officer was testifying. So it's the exact same thing. She just disregarded the court's ruling and talked about it anyway during closing argument.
But then here we're stuck with the problem, number one, that the defense doesn't make any objection, and number two, you would think if anybody was disturbed about that, it might have been the district court judge, but he doesn't seem to give any curative instructions. I think he gives the regular instruction, right, that just says you're the judges of the facts and the arguments of counsel aren't evidence.
And that's why we're in the realm of plain error, because there was no objection. But all these cases, they're plain error. I think almost all or all of the cases we cite where there's reversal in similar circumstances are plain error cases. And then maybe I can just touch on the last issue, the sentencing issue. There's no dispute that the court based the sentence on an erroneous finding here. That was the issue about whether the passenger side window was up or not. Mr. McMath actually testified that it was down, not up, and the court got that wrong, and the government concedes it. The issue is, well, what do you do about that now? And so we cite several cases where this court has ruled that, you know, whereas here it's unclear whether the same sentence would be imposed, a remand is warranted. And there are several reasons it's warranted in this case. The court focused on this particularly because it felt that it was an egregious form of perjury, given that there was a photograph of the window that showed whether it was open or closed. And he believed that Mr. McMath was testifying against this photo. And he gave him an opportunity during the sentencing hearing to recant on that, and then ended up sending him at the bottom of the guidelines. So all that suggests that there may be a possibility of a reduced sentence on remand. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Santelli.
May it please the Court. My name is James Santel. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. Good morning, Your Honor. Let me begin with Judge Wood's comments about the nature, the extent to which the case really hinged on credibility. That is the government's principal position in the context of the prosecutor's remarks. This is not a situation where we had a great deal of material evidence that related to items or other facts. This is all about people recounting an event in different ways. The testimony of the officers was at least principally at odds with the testimony of the defendant. And so credibility was an issue throughout the trial, not just in closing argument, not just in rebuttal, but throughout all the testimony. And so it wasn't just the case that this was an open door. That was what the case was all about. What did Ms. Blackwood, my colleague, say? Well, she said three different things of the subject of the appeal on these prosecutorial statements. First, she said the officers, Boyack and Washington, were not out to get Mr. McMath. They're to get guns off the street, and there's no reason to discount those words. That's the first set of things that she said. The second one, which we acknowledge was improper because of the reference to the loss of jobs, was that they're not just out to get McMath, they didn't perjure themselves, that would be unethical, that would be the loss of their job. And this Court has instructed well in Johnson-Dix that that is an improper statement. We concede that. We understand that. And the final comment was just a summary at the end of her closing about the fact that this is clear and credible testimony from the officers, admittedly in opposition to what the defense has said, but clear and credible testimony. At no point during the course of her closing argument, during the course of the rebuttal, does she say, I know, I think, I believe, you should believe because I believe, all those kinds of words that this Court has admonished prosecutors about. Instead, what she's doing is she's encouraging the jury to make reasonable inferences from testimony, testimony that she says, in fact, is credible. And that's
the point. What's the difference between saying this is credible testimony and I believe that this is credible testimony?
I think the difference, Judge, would be if Ms. Blackwood had simply said that without talking about the things you already discussed this morning, which is she described during the course of her closing, again during the rebuttal, all the evidence that the officers had described in the course of their testimony. This wasn't just Ms. Blackwood getting up there and saying, you heard credible testimony. This is good evidence. This is strong. This is a good case. So convict. Those comments come in the context of, and frankly, at the end of her representations for what the case said. If she had gotten up there and done the same thing and then inserted those words, then I think we'd have a tougher argument before you. But we don't have that today. What we have is someone who's summarizing evidence in a way that the jury can understand and then encouraging them to come to the conclusion that it is, in fact, credible, it's believable, it's consistent.
So wouldn't it have been better if she'd said, I ask that you find the defendant guilty based upon the clear and really thorough testimony of the law officer or something? You know, the officers do give a detailed account of their pursuit of this car and the headlights and motion and all the rest of it.
It's my view of the record that she comes very close to doing just that. I don't know that I'd parse
language. What's that word, credible, that makes us start worrying about vouching?
It does. It adds another aspect to this that wouldn't be there if you simply said, I'd like you to find you should find based upon this testimony that the defendant is guilty of the offense. But once again, the credibility issue was key throughout this trial. And so the insertion of that adjective, if you will, in the context of her comments does not undermine an otherwise strong and fairly solid closing argument or rebuttal.
I'd like you to move on to Batson, Mr.
Yes. Court, I think, has once again accurately noted what happens here.
Talk to you about what actually happened here. Is the extent of the dialogue from the court, all right, this is the court, after Mr. Erickson says, I have an issue about Juror 7. And then at the end of what is a very brief exchange says, the Batson challenge is denied. All right?
That's it. That's the record.
That is the record. Now, without asking you whether or not you're trying to undermine Snyder, as I read Snyder, it says where the trial court does not make findings regarding the prosecutor or juror's demeanor, an appellate court, and now the quote, cannot presume that the trial judge credited the prosecutor's assertion. So do we even have the room to accept your argument, the mandate, as I see it, of the court?
You do, Judge. If you read Snyder, and obviously the court has, that case needs to be understood in the context of its facts as well. There are lots of things going on there in Snyder, a whole lot more focus on Batson issues, particular reasons proffered by the government, responses back and forth.
Yes, but the Supreme Court doesn't take cases just because of the facts, and they don't issue opinions for one case only. You know, that's not the high court's role as I see it. So you think there's room here for us to say that this clearly the most minimum exchange by a judge, I would guess, that I've seen in the Batson situation, passes muster. This is the standard that you would say is acceptable for an inquiry by the judge.
I think it's appropriate to the circumstances as they're presented. In that real-world circumstance, when you are standing in front of the judge and there is a question about a particular juror,
sure.
The exchange is as brief as you've recounted it. What is not happening here is there is no prima facie case. This is not a situation where defense counsel approached the judge and said, Ms. Blackwood has identified this African-American juror. She has also treated white jurors differently. The demeanor that she has shown toward them, all those kinds of things that, frankly, might have been a part of Snyder, might have been part of other cases where that's problematic, that wasn't here. All that was alleged here was that there was an African-American juror, one of two prospective African-American jurors, who was stricken.
No, that's not right, though. I mean, Mr. Erickson points out the only information we have is that he was retired. There are other jurors left on the jury that are retired. He's somebody who worked somewhere. And then when the angry demeanor comes up, he says there are other people who had that as well. I mean, it's a skimpy record, but it's a little richer than I think you're making it.
It is. Again, we'd like it to be more than it is, frankly. There's no doubt about that. But the point of the presentation that I'm making is that on the record in front of the judge that day, there was not a sufficient basis for the judge to entertain the colloquy that takes place in Snyder. And
Mr. Erickson says, in response to Ms. Blackwood's assessment that he looked angry and not happy to be here, Mr. Erickson says, I think the whole jury looks that way. But not challenging that is an inappropriate response. Ms. Blackwood says, I disagree. So now we have an assessment of the, assessment of the attention span, if you will, of the jury, and then no assessment or balancing by the judge. So why is it that we say, is it just that the statement of Mr. Erickson that the whole jury looks to be look that way is weaker than Ms. Blackwood's I didn't see that expression?
Right.
I mean, what are we left with here? What kind of review can we have of the assessment other than, I guess, the court in concluding in the next line, the Batson challenge is denied, is that the quote argument of Ms. Blackwood, I didn't see that expression, carries the day. Is that what I should read from that, Mr. Santel?
It is. That is what the record is.
No, and I know you're not. Right. And I understand you wish it were more fulsome, and you didn't make the record. But I'm saying to you, what should I do? Should I say that that's what the judge did? He thought that the assessment, I guess that's what you're asking, the assessment of Ms. Blackwood that she didn't see it, is that the judge, what, one, didn't see it, or two, he disagrees with the assessment of Mr. Erickson that the whole jury looked that way?
Or there's even a three, that he's made a legal error and thought that the fact that one African-American is still on the panel is enough to make it unimportant that another one has been struck, which we all understand would be wrong, and I'm sure the district judges don't usually make legal errors like that, but you don't know in this record. That's also there on the table.
Sure. I think this discussion, which is entirely appropriate given the evidentiary record in front of you, underscores this fundamental point. That is, if there had been more exposition by the defendant about these kinds of things, if we didn't have, whether Judge Bauer is right or not, these fairly flip comments about, well, no one's really happy to be here, and we all sort of look that way, which could be read humorously. That may not be a part of some official record-type analysis under Batson. If that had been developed, if, as I was indicating before, there had been some suggestion about behavior by Ms. Blackwood that's more than simply striking the witness and then coming forward and saying that he appeared angry and not happy to be here. That's what Judge Clevert was looking at. And under those circumstances, what he is saying effectively, and the way that I would read this, Judge Flom, is to say that he looked at that and said, that's not a prima facie case. And even, as we say in our brief, even if that is somehow construed oddly and very circuitously as a prima facie case, the fact is that that kind of statement, a hint in body language, demeanor kind of statement, that's sufficient.
Oh, no, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. But what is suggested is that he's not interested in being here, and I suppose retired or unretired, you can be uninterested, although my experience through the years is retired people sometimes find the court an attractive venue for, if no other reason, to witness the proceedings.
Yes.
But it is what it is.
And again, it is our view that on this record, the analysis simply is sufficient based upon what's proffered by the defense. In the third prong, of course, when the court looks to whether or not there has been some discriminatory purpose in going ahead with this, the burden still is upon the author of the challenge to the strike. And whether one stops at the first prong, the second prong, or the third prong, at none of those along the way does Judge Clavert have a sufficient basis on which to do anything but deny that Batson challenge. And I don't mean to indicate that for that reason the court should dropkick any sort of instruction about analysis the district court should be doing, but simply that at every step of the way, Judge Clavert acted properly given in the exchange that it happened. I'd like to believe that if, in fact, there had been a greater record, if the jury had been dismissed, if there had been some other in-camera proceedings about this, and there had been some a much more focused and serious presentation about a discriminatory purpose and the third prong, or simply a prima facie case, that this would have been much more developed.
We should read in that he didn't find a prima facie case.
That's our position, yes, Judge. Yes.
Before you have to sit down, I'm bothered by the fact that the judge appears to be wrong about the only reason he really brings forth on the obstruction enhancement over around pages 20 and 21 of the sentencing hearing, which is A27, A28. He's all worried about this window on the passenger side, and that's really not at all what Mr. McMath is talking about. I mean, you've offered a bunch of speculative reasons in your brief about, well, maybe this, maybe that, maybe some other thing would have justified it, but isn't that just so much speculation? Don't we need the district judge to be the one finding those facts?
The judge plainly got it wrong. There's no doubt that he looks at photographs and misinterprets some testimony, and we acknowledge that. The question I would offer is whether or not that particular finding on whether the window is half up, half down, which side of the car the window was located on, those kinds of things that he probably did mix up at that time, is that the kind of material significant thing that one looks at when one goes to the issue of obstruction to 3C1.1? With all due respect to this fairly limited factual body that you have in front of you, the key elements of this were the two things that the judge did, in fact, identify. He says that McMath denied he was aware that the gun was there, no knowledge, no understanding of what he had done, no acknowledgement that he had thrown it out the window, and also then that he was seated on the driver's side. That's also related to the way in which he was behaving at that time. Those are material facts.
Well, they are, but, I mean, I'm looking at this paragraph, and he says, you didn't tell the truth when you took the stand in this case, and if your perjury were not as clear, the court might be more inclined to cut you a break. And then, unfortunately, that's when he goes on, and he doesn't say what you just said. He just talks about this window business. So do we really know that this enhancement is what he would have chosen if he had taken that next step that we keep saying judges have to take and explain exactly what it is that was the perjurious testimony? Why was it material? Why does it justify the enhancement?
It's the government's view that this record does do that with respect to those other two elements that the judge describes. Admittedly, it is not in the great detail that he goes into with respect to the window, but it is there, and that's sufficient. That's sufficient under this kind of a finding. He sat through the trial. He observed the demeanor of all the witnesses, including especially that of the defendant, and made this determination that
it's,
he was...
It's pretty broad. I mean, it reminds me of the old, you know, Kremlinologists who were deconstructing little statements that came out and trying to figure out what they meant.
The review that this court gives to that kind of determination, obviously, is a de novo review, but it is still clear error. Is there some clear error here that the judge has made in imposing that 3C1.1 enhancement? And on this record, with what he saw during the course of the trial, and again, the two specific things that he did get right, even though he was fairly summary in his discussion of those, without assuming to know what was inside the judge's mind, it may well have been that his view was those are so clear and those are so compelling that I don't need to spend a lot of time on them. He then launches into this discussion about the windows and misstates some significant portions of the testimony. with all of that, it remains our position, Your Honor, that the judgment of the district court should be affirmed. I thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Santel. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I just have a couple of brief points. One, you're absolutely correct. There's no room under Snyder for affirming here, given the minimal record. I mean, there's no example the government cites where.
How close are we to the case you submitted from the Second Circuit?
Well, I think the case.
It's a habeas, right?
It's a habeas case. I don't think that that's very relevant to the court's ruling. We noted it in our letter for, you know, in the interest of disclosure. But basically, I think the case in the Second Circuit, it was weaker than our case, because at least there the number one, there was more of a record. It was more than just saying, oh, Batson's denied. So there was some findings there about, I note that some of the other jurors are overweight. The issue there was the obesity. Here you don't have any findings. The other thing is there you might think that the obesity excuse is pretty flimsy, but at least the prosecutor had some kind of theory that somehow obese people and those of us with a few extra pounds might disagree, but might be more sympathetic to the defendant. But here the prosecutor, I mean, you came up, Your Honor, with some kind of explanation, but it wasn't offered by the prosecutor that somebody who's unhappy might not be as eager to participate in the proceedings. That wasn't in the record. She just said, oh, that person looks unhappy, and I can't say anything else. Then with respect to the prima facie case, one thing, I didn't hear the government ever rebut our point in our brief that Hernandez says that issue's moot. Now that the government offered a race-neutral explanation. So I think that's a red herring as well. I mean, this case is pretty much indistinguishable from Taylor, where you've got a juror stricken for a reason that was not applied to other jurors, and that's enough for a prima facie case under this court's decisions. And then finally, I just want to point to the one statement that the government relied on heavily with respect to misconduct, this issue, at the statement at the end about clear and really clever, credible testimony. That was just one of the many statements we cite, but it's really not tied to the evidence. If you look at A-174, the prosecutor starts out by saying, you don't need DNA evidence, you don't need fingerprint evidence, and then she goes on, as we pointed out in our reply, to misstate the reasonable doubt test, saying that, okay, even if there were DNA or fingerprint evidence, that wouldn't disprove the government's case, and then say so. And then she says, so ladies and gentlemen, once again, there is no reasonable doubt in this case. So she's not only not really tying it to the evidence, but then she goes ahead and misstates the reasonable doubt standard, suggesting that Mr. McMath had to disprove the government's case, and then she says that the officer's testimony was really credible. So even this statement right here, if you looked at that alone and ignored all the other statements, including the one the government concedes was improper, would warrant reversal. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Thanks to all counsel. Mr. Smith and Mr. Hernandez, I want to give you an additional thanks from the court for accepting this appointment. Our thanks to your firm, and we commend you for the able job you did in representing Mr. McMath. All right.